This is the BBC.
Thank you for downloading this edition of the Westminster Hour with Carolyn Quinn. You can find more information about the programme on the BBC website. MPs will be returning from their Easter break this week, and I'll be joined live here in the studio by two of them just after 10:30. Before that, though, with the second in his eight-week series, the BBC's former political editor, Nick Robinson.
Carolyn, ask people what makes them proud to be British, and they'll often say the NHS. After all, the opening ceremony of the Olympics featured it at its centre, with nurses jumping up and down on health service beds. That's why some people call it our national religion. But is it time to listen to the heretics, those who say it is scarcely coping now, it won't be able to in the future, and therefore something dramatic has to change? Because after all, however much we seem to put in, never seems to be quite enough.
What has happened in the NHS over the last 6 years? More patients being treated, more calls to the ambulance service, more operations, more doctors, more nurses. That's what's been happening in the NHS.
How long have you been waiting for?
7 hours.
We need beds and staff. It's just like banging your head against the brick wall.
People lined up in corridors on beds.
The amount of babies that are sat on corridors is absolutely ridiculous. It's heartbreaking.
As a doctor, how do you feel when you see babies like that?
It's unfair.
That was the sound of the Prime Minister saying that the NHS has had and is getting more, and staff and patients at the Royal Blackburn Hospital saying that's not how it feels to them. So what, if anything, is the solution to that problem? I'm joined to discuss that by Carol Sikora. He's one of the nation's leading oncologists. He used to run cancer services at Hammersmith Hospital in London. Since then, though, he's been making his living in the private sector, setting up a chain of private cancer centres, and he's dean of the country's only private medical school. Alan Milburn is here too. He is a wise man. That is the name being given to the trio of former health ministers from the three main UK parties who are writing proposals for the future of the NHS. He used to run the health service as Secretary of State for the NHS in England under Tony Blair. Nick McPherson's here. He's the man who used to tell ministers like Alan Milburn what they could spend and much more regularly what they could not. For more than a decade, he was the Treasury's top official, serving Chancellors Brown, Darling, Osborne. He is now a crossbench peer. And finally, Alison Pollock, who, like Carol Sikora, is a professor, in her case, of public health research and policy. She's based at Newcastle University and joins us from the city. Welcome to you all. Let me begin, Carol Sikora, with asking you, is the NHS really in a crisis, or isn't it just always like this?
No, it really is in crisis. I've been a consultant in the NHS for nearly 40 years, and I've never seen the unfulfilled demand that we've got in the service, as you heard in Blackburn. And the three problems: ageing population with complex, multiple illnesses that need individual treatment, demand for services, which is insatiable, even with trying to suppress demand with telephone lines like NHS 111 and so on. And then the third thing is medical innovation. In my field, cancer, the cost of treating optimally a patient is escalating more than 10% per year. And we're seeing that year on year. And of course, the treatments can be given in older people. Don't get me wrong, having older people is a triumph for the NHS. Otherwise, they wouldn't exist. So the fact that the average age now of survival is 82, if you add men and women, compared to 67 after World War II, is a triumph of the NHS.
A triumph, but perhaps an unaffordable one with the system we have.
Exactly.
Alison Pollock, right or wrong?
Well, we do have a political crisis, and it's really about what we want as a society. In 1948, the NHS was given to us as an entitlement to universal healthcare, cradle-to-grave healthcare. And the politicians have lost faith with that. And the crisis at the moment is being manufactured by politicians. We have less going into the NHS. Indeed, we had seen the withdrawal of the entitlements in 2012 with the Health and Social Care Act. So the NHS is now withering away. We have less money going in, a real fall as a percentage of GDP. We do not have a demographic time bomb. There is no crisis in the ageing. We do have an ageing population, but all the evidence shows that actually all the expenditure is in the last 6 months of life, so it's nearness to death that counts.
It doesn't matter, you mean, if you're 65 or you're 85, it's the last
30.
Few weeks.
So well, Monica, older people also put more in than they take out, and also we have real reductions because we have a compression of morbidity. People are living longer and healthier lives, and older people put more in. So the scapegoating of older people has to stop.
You're picking figures carefully, though, aren't you? Saying we're spending less as a share of national income. That's what percentage of GDP means. We are spending more than we ever have. The spending is going up in real terms. The number, as the Prime Minister claimed, of nurses and doctors and so on, has been going up. So does that not mean we're reaching a point where it's very hard for the NHS to deliver?
Absolutely not at all. We're about the lowest in a percentage of GDP of all OECD countries. What, the percentage that we spend on the NHS as a percentage of gross domestic product has fallen from 7.3% to 6.6% as a share. Germany and France are up at 9% and 10%. And, of course, America, which is the most extravagant and unfair system in the world, is at 18%.
There we are. We've heard the defence, Alan Milburn. And it's the politicians, it's you guys that have got it wrong. If you'd only kept faith with the NHS, you'd only spent a bit more money, as they do in Europe, all would be fine.
Curiously, I think both Carol and Alison are right. It is true the NHS is facing unprecedented pressure. If you think, for example, of hospital admissions, they've risen by about a third during the course of the last decade or so. Waiting times for treatment, which had fallen from a maximum of 18 months to around 18 weeks in the early 2000s, are now rising again. Two in three NHS trusts are in financial trouble. The litany goes on and on. It is true that spending is rising, but it is rising at a far slower rate than it has done historically. If you go back to 1950, on average, the NHS was receiving real terms increases each and every year of around 3.5%. In these last few years, it has been barely half of that. So we've got a system that is underfunded, but I would also argue that it is underreformed. And what we need to do is we need to get the right level of resources in, but we need to fundamentally change the system. This is where Carol is right. The system was created to deal with the 20th century problem, episodic care in hospitals. Our big problem today is the fact that we're all living longer. That's a blessing, not a curse, but we've got a demographic challenge, we've got a disease challenge of chronic disease, and that requires more continuity of care in the community.
And this programme is going to talk about how we change the NHS, if we do, not just an argument about who spent what, but let's deal with spending first, Nick McPherson. It's all your fault. You're in charge of austerity at the Treasury. The argument goes, if you'd spent even what Margaret Thatcher did, about 3% increase in real terms year in year under the Thatcher administration valve, all would be fine.
Well, the problem is that 9 years or so into a so-called austerity, we haven't yet got the deficit to an acceptable level. There are a whole lot of commitments which successive governments have made in addition to the health service, the so-called triple lock on the state pension, the NATO commitment on defence, commitments on spending on schools, an obsession with spending 0.7% of the national income on overseas aid. All of these pressures are crowding out potential money which could be spent on the health service.
Now, you have argued, yes, we should spend more on the NHS, but maybe we had to find a new way of doing it, as politicians found it really very difficult to argue for tax rises.
I think that's right. This is about enabling citizens to relate the tax they pay to the services they get. I think the only successful discretionary tax increase in peacetime that I can remember at the Treasury was Gordon Brown's increase in national insurance in 2002, which was part of a package agreed with Alan Milburn and Tony Blair to get a serious amount of money into the National Health Service over a five-year period.
And I think Nick would agree it was probably the most popular tax rise there has ever been, because people knew that it was earmarked for a particular national priority, the National Health Service. They agreed with that. And, of course, it was accompanied by a series of pretty far-reaching reforms.
So, Alison, just before you come in, let's get Nick to spell out the idea.
And I think even more importantly, it reflected a year-long debate about the resources the National Health Service needed, so that citizens could actually understand the reason the government was increasing tax and could relate to the proposal and indeed support the proposal.
Now, you've argued, though, not to simply repeat that, not just another 1%, but something that's a sophistication, if you like, of that idea.
There is this appalling term, hypothecation.
So we call it a dedicated tax, a committed tax.
A dedicated tax. The reason I argue for this is that we need a long-term plan. We need security of resources. And the more those resources can be explicitly linked to a tax, the more likely those resources are likely to go into the National Health Service.
And the controversial thing you've suggested is that that national insurance will be paid by the elderly. Of course, they don't pay it if they're not working
yes.
at the moment.
One of the problems with national insurance is that only people under 65 pay it. And I think it's essential, now that pensioners are really quite well off, that they pay it too.
Alison.
Hypothecation is a bit of an old chestnut. And the problem is, goes back to the fundamental question, if we believe in universal healthcare, how should it be funded? And the World Health Organization, the World Bank and the Treasury have all said repeatedly it should be through central taxation. That's the fairest way of doing it. And hypothecation has problems because it's not always the amount that you link is the amount that you need. The second issue I'd like to say is that we're getting diverted here because it's also where is the money going that we're raising? And at the moment, billions and billions of pounds are going out to private for-profit corporations, to lawyers, to management consultants. So we're being diverted with the money argument. We do need more money, but we need to see where it's being spent and how it's being spent.
And I'm going to come back to the structure of the way the health service is organised in just a second. Let's deal with money first, though, if we could. Alan, then Carol.
So I think Nick's proposal is an interesting one, but it effectively answers one question, which is a how question. How should we raise more money in order to properly fund the system of care that we have? And by the way, this is a system of care. It's not just the National Health Service. It's also social services. They're two sides of the same coin, because if you're an elderly person or you have a mental health problem or a disability, you rely on both. The fundamental question that we have to answer is the what question. What level of resourcing is required? And I think what we now need is, one, we need to be assessing the demand pressures that are coming through, whether that's demography or disease. Secondly, we need to be determining what level of resources we need for the long term in order to cope with those pressures. But then thirdly, we need to think about the various changes and reforms that will best get the optimum use of those resources if we're going to put them in.
Carol Segura, if overnight the politician here and the former senior civil servant there said, look, don't you worry your head about how I raise the money. We'll get you the money. Mm-hmm. We can do what Alison Pollock wants. We will get you a share of the national cake for health as big as they have in Germany, as big as they have in France. Would you at that point then say, problem solved?
No, I think the problem will continue. Getting money in is one solution, but also reducing demand on the system, reducing high-cost demand, people demand, most of the costs are staff costs in the system, and we have to reduce the demand. You can do that in two ways. You can do it the way we're doing it now, postcode prescribing, rationing. It's totally unfair because the savvy patients know how to work the system and tend to achieve. Those that are less savvy, less well-educated, see it as an impenetrable system.
Rationing is the economist term, really, isn't for a waiting list,
exactly.
Isn't it? If you're sitting on a waiting list, exactly. Literally it is being rationed. You're not getting it when
you
want.
And then the second thing you can do to reduce demand is make the customer at least partially pay for the service. Now, Alison's going to hate me for saying that, but some sort of co-payment, it may be a very modest co-payment, is a common tool throughout Europe.
Let's break the code again. By a co-payment, you mean?
When you use the health service, you pay something each time you use it. It may be very small, you have exemptions, rather like prescription charges. They're a co-payment, if you like, in the UK, in the NHS.
And if you go to France, for example, go to see a GP, I think it's about €20 now for that appointment. You sometimes get the money back, but you have to pay up front. And a consultant, you pay about €50 to go.
It's not the money going into the system, it's the dampening demand that you're getting from that. So you avoid trivial use of very high-cost services.
Alison Pollock.
You've no evidence for this at all, Carol. In fact, all the evidence shows from the WHO, from the World Bank, that user charges are unfair, they're regressive, and no matter how you have them, they don't work, they act as real barriers to care, which is why Ireland, for example, at the moment, is going to get rid of its GP charges and hospital charges.
So, Alison, can I put the question to you that I put to Carol? If you could magically, via politicians, find a way of having the money, what's the evidence it would work? Some people might look at Scotland and say that Scotland gets more than £100 a head extra spent on its health service compared with England, but more people die in Scotland than die in England. The NHS does not, therefore, perform better.
Scotland has abolished prescription charges and it's also abolished personal care charges because Scotland has very, very high levels of poverty, and that is why it gets a little bit more money per head of population. And the determinants of health go much wider than actually healthcare. Healthcare contributes to ameliorating health and narrowing inequalities, but it's all the other factors that are important, such as employment, such as where you live, and such as your income.
Alan Milburn. The problem with Carol's co-payment is that it doesn't work on either equity grounds or efficiency grounds. So, of course, we have some element of charges in the NHS for eyes and teeth and prescriptions and so on and so forth in England. But all of the international evidence suggests that if you extend these further into core services, it disadvantages the poor and the old, and they're primarily the people who rely upon healthcare, and it is deeply inefficient. So, look, people say about the NHS that it's a bureaucracy. We spend 2p in every pound on administration in the National Health Service. It's 5p in Germany, it's 6p in France, and it's a whopping 10p precisely because of all of these charges and co-payments in America. So I think the drift towards an American-style healthcare system is the last thing that we should do.
Nick McPherson.
I think we should be at least prepared to experiment with co-payment, as it's called. As Carol mentioned, we've done it with prescription charges.
Well,
I think the first place I would start are people who don't turn up for appointments. If you talk to anybody, I was talking to someone who works in the NHS in my own home only this morning, and she was saying that the amount of patients who don't show up, DNAs, as they're known in the trade.
What's that?
Does add to the inefficiency of the service.
To be clear, though, wearing your old Treasury hat, yes, charging, let's say, £10 for someone who fails to show at the GP's is not going to raise any meaningful sum for the health service, but it might just put people off a bit.
It would nudge people into appearing. I agree with Alan. Look, you don't want huge bureaucracy and payments.
But that's exactly what happens. If you start charging in that way, somebody's got to do the billing, somebody's got to do the recalling, somebody's got to stuff the envelopes.
Which is why, Alan, I think there
are better and fairer ways of doing precisely what you've suggested. For example, we know that the international evidence suggests that if you give patients their state-funded individual budget so they can determine the care that they want, two remarkable things happen. One, levels of patient satisfaction rise, and two, levels of public spending actually fall.
I think those are all good points. All I'm saying is it would be worth experimenting with it, perhaps in a pilot scheme. The fact is, people pay very high fees for their social care. I'm not saying that's right, but they do. So there are a lot of anomalies in the system, and it is worth looking across the board at them.
But Carol Sikora, you still don't think this is enough?
I think we have to dampen demand somehow. It's going through the roof. The DNAs did not attend is an example. About 10% of cancer follow-up appointments are DNAs at the moment. And that's people don't care. They don't value it because it's completely free.
You've compared it with the salad bar. You know, you go down to Pizza Express.
Yeah, and you know, you fill yourself up in a salad bar because it's all free. You don't necessarily eat it all. A little bit of that mentality is in the NHS when it's free.
Well, Carol, as you well know, clinics deliberately overbook their clinics because they know that a certain percentage of patients won't attend for whatever reasons. The second issue is that the studies have shown that patients have a real trouble actually notifying the administration about why they can't attend. You can't get through on the phone to tell them that you won't attend. It always overbooks. You go to your GP surgery, there's always overbooking to take into account.
It's a feeling of value of the service. Anything
people
that's free is not
service.
Valued.
Absolutely and, rubbish.
No, I really agree with that. You can't say it's rubbish, Alison. Every consumer, it makes the patient
the
a proper consumer.
Why is it the most popular institution in the whole of the country if it's not valued?
There may be a difference, Alison Bullard, between valuing it and putting a value financially on it. But let's move on to structure, because we've talked about payment and tax. We've talked about the possibility of charging what's known in the jargon of co-payment. But I sense, Carol Sikora, even if those things were both done, there's still something fundamentally you don't like about the way the NHS is organised and think it could be done in a different way.
There are new ways of doing things. I think the private sector is very innovative. It changes things. It has to change. It has to keep up to date. Innovative not just with technology, that's a given, but innovative of the way in which services are provided. And I think allowing more experiments involving the private sector in defined areas of care. So my business, cancer care, let's just do that. We get expert at, we run, you know, eventually a whole lot of units for the NHS rather than having general hospitals discovering the wheel with cancer care. Same for cardiac care, same for diagnostics. The majority of MRI scans done for the NHS are done in the private sector, unknowing to the patient. The scanners, they're in NHS hospitals, they're profit-making companies that are using them.
Alan Milburn, when you were Health Secretary, you used some of this language, did you not, of competition, the internal market, which the Tories had had. It's what upset quite a lot of people in the Labour Party and still does.
I remember it
outside.
Well.
But you still believe, do you, that it is right that a centralised structure you think can't deliver?
I think monopolies in any walk of life, whether they're public or private, they're not characterised, frankly, either by operational efficiency or by customer responsiveness. That's why I think you need a variation of what Carol says, which is a managed market inside the NHS so that we utilise the best of the private sector, the best of the public sector, and we do so based upon Alison's core principles, care being provided according to need and not ability to pay. And if you think about some of the great advances now that we're seeing in the world with technology and big data and precision-based medicine and genomic science, much of this is coming from the private sector, and what we should be doing is harnessing that. And the beauty of the National Health Service, unlike other healthcare systems, is if we do that, then we can ensure that those benefits, rather than being made available just to some people in our country, can genuinely be made available to all.
Now, Alison Pollock, you, I assume, think that all that means is those big increases in costs that you talked about earlier, the cost of running the NHS, cost going in profit, cost going in duplication, that is what will result.
Absolutely. We've got the evidence already. Alan talked about the drift to the American experiment. And the result is cuts in GP surgeries, closures of hospitals, closures of mental health services, and the money is being diverted to shareholders and the huge transaction costs of the market.
Okay,
it's
I want
very
to ask you
expensive and bureaucratic.
But Scotland has, if you like, retained the kind of classic Coke approach to the NHS, hasn't it? Healthcare is run by public boards. There's less involvement of the private sector. Can you point to Scotland and say, if only the whole of the UK had a system identical to the Scottish system, no one would be talking about having a crisis in the NHS? Because they do talk about a crisis in Scotland.
Well, this is another political crisis, another scaremongering, scapegoating tactic. But actually, the really important thing to say is in Scotland and Wales, they have no hospitals and financial deficits, no hospitals competing each other to close, and no hospitals that have been set up. All our trusts now in England have been set up to be 49% private so they can income generate and turn NHS beds and staff to looking after private patients.
But ideology,
that is not happening in Scotland. It is ideology, of course it is.
Ideology is a really bad prescription for the National Health Service. What surely counts are only two things: quality of care for the patient, efficiency of use of resource for the taxpayer, and frankly, patients are indifferent as to whether the services are provided by a public provider or a private provider. What they want is high quality, deep efficiency.
Carol Segura.
What Alan's saying is completely true. Patients don't care. They do care about outcomes. The soft outcomes during treatment, for example, whether people are nice to them, whether they're waiting. NHS traditionally doesn't value patients' time as a factor. But the ultimate outcome is success in the intervention, whatever disease it's for.
I want to return to this notion of a restructure. There are some people who argue that when you look around the world, Nick McPherson, the healthcare systems that are being really successful take a little bit of money and they say, we will spend it on keeping you out of expensive healthcare. I think New York State does this now. There's an experiment called Kaiser Permanente, which has been talked about, saying large groups of people treated at a real emphasis on prevention and not on how you treat people once they reach the doctor and once they reach the hospital.
Clearly, healthcare becomes cheaper if you can keep people out of hospital. And those experiments, I think, have a lot to teach us. And I do think we need greater diversity of provision, not least to see what works and what doesn't. For me, The critical issue is that it's free at the point of use, not which bits are provided by the private sector.
Absolutely. Kaiser Permanente operates, it's like a health insurer, so it operates in different parts of the states. It started off in the West Coast for the steel workers because they had no healthcare insurance, but it doesn't give universal coverage and it heavily selects out patients.
Carol Sikora, you have argued that there should be what you refer to as mutuals, the idea of the old sort of Victorian friendly societies, maybe even the trade unions in the past would have performed this role. Is the idea, though, to have a series of different providers of health, not necessarily private profit-making, some may well be. Why?
Well, I think a great example of that is the whole hospice movement delivering palliative care in this country. It came out of the charity sector. And then now it's jointly run by still by charity sectors, but also the NHS in partnership. And that has just been remarkably successful. And it's a transformation of a service. It was all there before. We had painkillers. We had nice nurses that would look after people at the end of life. But it just wasn't put together. Now it is. And that came from outside the system. And that's what we need to see. Models like that to experiment with.
Now, it's your old special advisor, political advisor, actually runs the NHS in England these days, Alan Milburn. Simon Stevens is his name, man with a beard. You see him on the telly from time to time. My sense is this is where his thinking is moving.
Yes, and I think he's on the right track. We know that today, study after study has come to exactly the same conclusion. 20 to 25% of patients who are in hospital today should never have been there in the first place or are desperate to get out. And yet, over the course of the last few years, spending on hospital-based care has been rising twice as fast as on primary care. Now, here we are in a world where it's diabetes and arthritis and dementia that are going to be the diseases and already are the diseases of the future. What they require, of course, is some hospital-based care, but primarily what they require is care in the community. And that's why we have to have new models of care, new structures, if you like, that are capable of integrating care between social services and health services, between primary care and acute-based care. Some of that is happening, but these changes need to go much further and much faster.
Now, I want to wind up with your thoughts about where we might be. How different might the NHS look and feel across the UK, even though, of course, each country of the UK runs its own healthcare system in its own way. Nick McPherson, you've sat through Tory governments, you've sat through Labour governments discussing this. Where do you think the debate is now moving and where do you think the health service is likely to end up in a few years' time?
Well, I think the first thing which has to be solved and therefore I assume will be at some stage is the interface between hospitals and primary care sector, in particular the interface for the elderly, social care. I think at last that debate is coming to the fore. And although some money has been put into it, I think actually reforming the system and the way money is budgeted is absolutely essential. So I think that's the first major change which will happen. The other is, I believe, that we will see greater diversity of provision, different models of delivery.
That's code for more private sector involvement, more voluntary organisations.
Look, I don't think we should be fetishistic about this. We've got to have a diverse system with an element of competition.
Carol Sikora, most of your life, you've argued, the private sector has some of the answers to the health service. Do you think it'll actually change dramatically in your lifetime?
I think it will. It really has to. And I think we're seeing it beginning with the integration of social care. Over the next decade, there will be a very different health service than we have today.
Alison Pollock, you've made a passionate argument for going back to basics, if you like. Do you think it'll happen?
Yes, it will if there's a political will to do so. That's why we have drafted the NHS Reinstatement Bill, which is currently in Parliament, and that would actually reinstate the NHS and our entitlements.
Alan Milburn.
I think we can genuinely have our cake and eat it. I think there is an enduring strength about the National Health Service. It is part of being British. It's based on the scale of your need, not the size of your wallet. That should continue. It should be free at the point of use. However, we need some far-sighted, far-reaching reforms in order to induce more competition, more innovation and more integration. And then finally, we've got to get the right level of funding. If we do all of those things, the NHS can be sustainable and its best days can lie ahead of it. But that, as Alison says, is in the end a political choice.
People often forget in this country that the arguments about healthcare that we have here simply don't take place in other countries. There is no national health service. There is no great national argument about how healthcare should be run. That argument, I'm sure, will carry on for the rest of my lifetime. One prediction I make, having listened to this conversation, is pretty soon a minister will promise to spend an awful lot of money again on the NHS, whether they're Tory or Labour, because the political pressure will build on them to do so. My thanks to Alison Pollock, Nick McPherson, Alan Milburn, Carol Sikora. Join us next time. Thank you.
Our thanks there to Nick, who recorded that discussion last week. He'll be back next week with part three of the series, Political Thinking. Now, with me, Carolyn Quinn, here in the studio, and live is the Conservative MP for East Worthing and Shoreham, Tim Lawton. He's a former children's minister and has been an MP since 1997. Welcome to you. Like Tim, my next guest has also been an MP since 1997, Labour's Barry Gardner, who represents Brent North. You've got two titles, haven't you? Shadow International Trade Secretary, Shadow Minister for International Climate Change. Nice to see you here as well. Mm-hmm. And here as well with us, welcome to Stephen Bush of The New Statesman. And Stephen, you'll be bringing us a look at the morning paper front pages before 11 o'clock. No doubt plenty of headlines about the situation in North Korea and the ratcheting up of tensions we've seen between Pyongyang and Washington. At least so far, I suppose it's a war of words just between President Donald Trump and the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. But now President Trump's national security advisor is saying an international consensus, including China, is emerging against what they say is North Korea's threatening behaviour. Barry and Tim, what do you imagine could be Britain's role in either supporting Donald Trump in any future endeavours or trying to calm down the situation?
I think we do have to calm down what has been really very alarming rhetoric, a unilateralist rhetoric that the USA has been spouting that says they could have a military solution here. I think what we do need is we need to support China's attempts to revive the six-country peace initiative that really has been stalled now for 7 or 8 years. But that regional initiative is important because it's China that can bring the real pressure to bear
but
on North Korea.
Why has it been stalled? I suppose that's the question.
Well, I think
why
partly,
would it revive now?
Partly that is because China has not been willing to put the force behind it that recently it has. Of course, China's now cut off coal imports. She could also cut off gas imports. And I think I would be very surprised if there had not been talking behind the scenes between Beijing and Pyongyang, which had made sure that that was not a nuclear test, as the North Koreans had said it was going to be, but then actually it was downgraded in the way that it was now. And in the event, it was a failure, of course. Yeah.
So, Tim Lawton, what do you imagine Theresa May might be saying to Donald Trump privately? I mean, there's been talk of a preemptive strike. We know that he's saying, I will deal with China, I will deal with North Korea. Would she back him in a preemptive strike?
Well, I think what Theresa May will be doing is giving wise counsel to Donald Trump, which hopefully he will listen to. And given that she was in the White House and established a relationship, whatever one thinks of Donald Trump, you can't give wise counsel advice to somebody unless you've actually got lines of communication with them. And that's what we've got. I agree with Barry. Crucial to all this is China. North Korea is a client state of China. If China decided to cut everything off, then Korea is in a very parlous state. The premier of China was in the States recently, so one assumes that there have been some quite wide-ranging discussions on this. We have good relationships with China. There's pressure we can bring to bear there as well. So there's lots of bellicose behaviour, there's lots of sabre-rattling, there's lots of gestures going on, but actually behind the scenes, I certainly think and I'm sure and I hope that there's some sensible diplomacy going on as well.
All right. Well, I'm sure we'll have more on that in the papers before the end of the programme. Stephen, for now, let's turn to more domestic matters. The brisk return to Westminster business after Easter, and MPs are back on Tuesday. For many, preoccupied by thought of next month's local and mayoral elections. Let's just set out where they're going to be. There'll be 34 councils in England, all 32 councils in Scotland, all 22 councils in May, in Wales on the 4th of May, and 8 mayoral elections in England. And there's a parliamentary by-election in Manchester, Gorton as well. These are big tests, aren't they? I mean, people think, gosh, after all the elections we've been through, maybe the local elections aren't that spine-tingling. But nevertheless, the first big test of public opinion since the EU referendum.
Yeah, since the referendum, and we will see if the effect that, if you like me, you're a sad by-election watcher. The Liberal Democrats have been doing very well since the referendum in local council elections. Now we find out if they can scale up, whether or not they can do what they did in Richmond and Whitney in a bigger scale. We find out just how bad the bleeding is for Labour, how whether or not their poll woes will be reflected in a real election, and whether or not Theresa May's remarkable popularity is as real as we think it is.
Lib Dem fight back in the southwest, in particular. I mean, Tim, your party, the Conservatives, do face a threat in the southwest from the Lib Dems, don't you?
I think to an extent. I think they've got a long way to come back. In my own constituency, it used to be a Liberal marginal. I don't have a single Lib Dem councillor at any level in my constituency. So I think the Lib Dem Democrats will do relatively well, but it's largely on the basis of a sort of reaction to Brexit by those people who are still unhappy about the result. And it's people, I've come across a lot of people, I've been canvassing on the doorsteps, who might have voted Labour, but now they're going to vote Lib Dem. So it's not a very positive vote for the Lib Dems. It's an alternative to the others who are worse.
But if there is a Lib Dem revival, as some are talking about, that does threaten some of those seats that you took at the last election.
Yeah, but I think it's early days to talk about a Lib Dem revival. And Stephen talks about some by-election results, and they've done quite well in by-elections, but I think it's been about three dozen local council by-elections. It's not a huge sample, and they're very good at by-elections, Lib Dems, as we know. These are nationwide elections. I think it's some faint rumblings of a revival, but they've got a long way to go from a very low base.
Stephen, last year Jeremy Corbyn defied his critics' dire warnings after Labour appeared to hold ground in the English council elections. He said people were predicting Labour was going to lose councils. We didn't. We hung on. And we grew support in a lot of places. This year, the predictions are dire again for Labour. Do you think Labour will hang on or lose what some people are saying could be up to 125, 150 seats?
I think they will lose seats. I mean, it's a much worse map. Even if the Labour Party was doing very well, even if their much-discussed problems weren't there, this would still be a horrible electoral map because of this slight Liberal fight back, how large it is remains to be seen. Because UKIP was starting to peak in 2013 and we assume that vote will return home largely to the Conservatives, there are many reasons why it would be bad for them. Throw in their other problems and yes, I expect them to lose, you know, at least 100, 125 seats.
And Barry, if Labour collapses in that way, loses seats, collapses completely in Scotland, as some are predicting.
Can I just point out, you started this by saying last year Jeremy Corbyn defied his critics by actually not doing badly.
Words were hanging on. You don't want to just hang on, do you?
But look, my point here is that always you guys try to personalise this around the leader. These are local elections. They are local elections with local councillors. Some local councillors will have done a sterling job for local people and they will be re-elected. Others may not have done. But every Conservative canvasser who's on the doorstep will have to answer three questions. Why are people earning 10% less today in real terms than they were 10 years ago in 2007? Why are there 200,000 fewer home owners in this country than there were in 2010? And why are there 1.8 million people waiting longer than 4 hours in A&D when in 2010 it was 350,000?
And Barry, those are legitimate questions.
And
I'm
that's
sure
what the Tories will have to answer. And that's
however,
why Labour will not need to defy
all
the
right.
critics in the way that you
okay,
suggest.
OK, Barry, in that case then, if that is the case and those questions are there being asked, why aren't Labour doing better? Why in the polls are Labour doing so badly? Why do the polls suggest that even among Labour voters, people prefer Theresa May to Jeremy Corbyn as a Prime Minister?
Look, because time and time and time again, you guys focus this around the personality of the leader instead of around the policies, OK? I'm trying to focus on the policies. On the doorstep, it's the policies I will be talking about. I will be talking about those things that the Tories have got wrong, and I will be talking about all the ways in which we're going to put it right. Positive solutions for a legal living wage of £10 an hour, building a million homes.
And there's been a flurry of announcements, we know,
in
recent weeks. There has been the announcements.
And it's an election campaign, and that's what you do on the election trail.
You go out there
and you make those policy commitments, and people then vote if they like your policies.
But you haven't got elections in London, and clearly you don't know what people are saying. And I've not had any single person...
He could be out on the doorstep as well.
I'm sure, presumably
helping some colleagues.
But I haven't had a single person, and I've been knocking on doors for the last 3 weeks, who said, I really like the Labour policy on such and such. What are you going to do about it? All they say is, well, thank goodness you're not the other lot.
Stephen Bush.
But the important sort of thing, which I think is getting lost in the back and forth, is actually what you would expect, ignoring everything else, is for the government to lose council seats and the opposition parties to finish net as a gain. So holding on last year was a bad result. Only the fact that the only group of people more inept at media management than Jeremy Corbyn are Jeremy Corbyn's opponents in the Parliamentary Labour Party means that that was presented as a good night. But actually, it was a very bad night. Holding on is a bad night. Losing seats is a catastrophic night, all of which points to a significantly worse result in 2020 than Labour got in 2015. And just from a kind of cephalological perspective, we really shouldn't lose sight of that basic truth.
All right, Stephen. And Barry, your fingers may be crossed, or you may be...
I hold my hands
His
up.
Hands...
You can see my hands, my fingers, my legs. Nothing is crossed.
Okay.
I'll just get out there. I'll do the work. I'll talk about policy. And I'll try not to run presidential-style local council elections.
And we'll talk to you again after the results. Now, Stephen, the election for the leader of the Unite Union moves a step closer this week, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Ballots have gone out. That closes on the 28th of April. The strong expectation is that Len McCluskey will see off his two rivals, Ian Allison to his left and Gerald Coyne to his right, which means basically, in terms of the sort of internal struggle within Labour, it's as you were. Len McCluskey is a kind of critical friend of Jeremy Corbyn's, and he will likely remain in place to be so if Gerald Coyne wins. However, that will change the balance of power gradually on Labour's ruling National Executive Committee. Although, of course, most of the people who vote in the Unite election are voting because of their jobs and services and their workplace issues. It is an election with consequences for Labour, but it is not an election about the Labour Party.
Although you might not think so, do you, Gerald Coyne talking sometimes.
Who are you supporting, Barry?
I will not be supporting anyone because I don't have a vote in that, because I'm not a member of Unite. I'm a member of the GMB.
Hypothetically, then.
No response. No, that's fine. He doesn't have a vote.
I don't have a vote. It's as simple as that.
Okay. Something else to look out for this week, a call from the chairman of the Environment Select Committee for owners of old diesel cars to be able to scrap their vehicles for cash in pollution hotspots. That's Neil Parish. He's reportedly planning to use a House of Commons debate on Wednesday to urge the government to commit to a targeted scheme to tackle emissions. Well, the way that the UK tackles environmental issues, indeed, after Brexit is something that worries Molly Scott-Cato, a Green MEP, the party's EU relations spokesman. She's written to the Brexit Secretary David Davis to ask about reports that the government is prepared to row back on environmental regulations in order to smooth the process of forging new trade deals. And she's asking whether the government's been carrying out secret studies into the potential impact of a hard Brexit. Sam McCrory asked her what she wants the letter to achieve.
We're very aware of the fact that there are a lot of plans being made about how laws will change as a result of our leaving the European Union. We've seen from various leaks that actually these plans are being made, but we don't know about them. So we're asking David Davis to release all the scenario planning he's doing and all the impact studies he's doing about what hard Brexit might mean to our economy, to our health service, and also to our environment.
But all existing EU laws and regulations are going to be absorbed into UK law under the so-called Great Repeal Bill. So what exactly are you worried about?
Well, obviously the clue is a little bit in the name there, which is Great Repeal Bill. So although there's this suggestion of cutting and pasting European law into UK law, after that happens, then it can be repealed. But actually the idea of just bringing law across en masse is not really very realistic. And if you speak to environmental lawyers, they will tell you that of the 1,100 pieces of EU law that currently protect our countryside and our water standards and our air quality standards and so on, many are likely to get lost and loopholes will be created if you just go in for some sort of mammoth cut-and-paste exercise. And also I'm worried because we've seen leaks, for example, a leaked document from the Foreign and Commonwealth Office that suggested that standards on climate change and on trade in endangered species should be reduced if it helps us get a trade deal. And we've seen leading Tories saying how we need to have a bonfire of regulations. So I think we're fairly clear about the direction that the government will take us and what their objective is. And this was also part of the objective, I think, in leaving the European Union, which has always been very strong in protecting our environmental standards. Some of the leading Brexiteers were actually people who didn't think climate change was man-made and people who were calling for a bonfire of regulation. You know, a lot of leading Tories wanted Brexit for that reason. And it's interesting because actually their voters don't agree with them about that. There's research that shows that 90% of Conservative voters think we should keep the same high standards of environmental protection, water quality, air quality and so on after Brexit. So there's a kind of ideological drive from the Tories and that does make me quite concerned.
But they will also say it's what Britain might need to do to establish new trading relationships in the post-Brexit world.
Yeah, so now what we're saying is people voted for Brexit and that means we have to reduce our standards of the environment, even though we know that's not what people wanted and actually that's not what was on the ballot paper. So this drive towards a hard Brexit is ideologically driven. There isn't a majority in the country for it. And that's why as Greens we're saying we very much need to stay in the single market and to keep the highest standards of environmental protection as well as employment protection and other standards.
Have you had a reply from David Davis yet?
It's quite slow to get replies from government departments and I'm not expecting to hear in a hurry. But I'm interested by the fact that there are a lot of leaks coming out and I think that will continue because when government's secretive, people leak. And it's particularly disturbing when 40 years worth of legislation is up for grabs here to think of them trying to hide behind closed doors and not having a fully public debate.
Molly Scott-Cato, Tim Lawton, do you think impact assessments are being done?
Yeah, and this is the Greens, again, using any angle to talk about hard Brexit and attack Brexit. Brexit does not mean reduced environmental standards. Why would we want it to? We've actually got a pretty good record in this country across many environmental standards. The UK Climate Change Act actually imposes tougher requirements for cutting carbon emissions than we'd have to comply with under the EU anyway.
But
we
can
are
you
perfectly
guarantee,
capable
though,
of being green ourselves.
Can you guarantee that once the repeal bill process happens and the whole of EU law is transferred onto the UK statute book, that green regulations and laws will survive that process?
Well,
because
rules
can be kept, amended, or ditched.
And changed and adapted to be more suitable to what we can achieve and want to achieve in the UK. I mean, we've actually done very well on renewable energy in this country. We're certainly on electricity. We're generating something like 30% of our electricity from renewable energy.
We're going to miss our 2020 renewables targets.
Yeah, but on electricity generation, we're up to 30%. On heating and transport, we've got a lot of work still to do. But we came from a low base. We're only generating 7% of electricity from renewables back in 2010.
Molly Scott-Cato obviously hasn't got the memo, has she? She hasn't been told that. There are real concerns. Do you think she's right to be concerned, Barry Gardner?
I do. Look, Tim's right. The Labour government put in place the Climate Change Act, and that was a landmark act, not just for this country, but for the whole world, actually, and it was the basis of the Paris Agreement.
And supported
but,
by us,
but
quite
if,
right.
Indeed, it was bipartisan. I'm afraid, though, when you look at something like the Air Quality Directive, which this government was opposing in Europe for many, many years, and has now been taken to our own Supreme Court twice and lost the case, this is a very good example of where the track record of this government is very bad. And that is precisely why, when you introduced this, Carolyn, by talking about the potential for a scheme that would pay £2,000 as a scrappage scheme for people to phase out their old diesel cars. That was the cue for this whole discussion. Because the Air Quality Directive has really not been observed by this government, and indeed the plan that they put in place, which was supposed to be remedying the problem, bringing it back in line by 2015, their plan wasn't going to bring it back even in 2025. So I think
Will
there are reasons
a
to be worried. worried.
Will people notice a difference after Brexit in environmental standards?
This is the point that was made by your interviewer of Polly Scott-Cato. He said, look, on day one, it'll all be the same. And, of course, on day one, it will. But on year one and year two and further afield, as Tim himself said, it may not be. And that's because we will then be in a position where we may change those regulations. But, of course, those regulations will then affect the trade that we can do with other countries. Because if we are not meeting the same standards, if we're not meeting the same regulations, then actually it will impair our capacity to trade with them.
I've got to move to the papers now and have a look at the front pages because, Stephen, you've got some of them. And let's have a look. Well, the events in Turkey this evening, the results of the referendum have hit the front pages.
Yes. Recep Erdogan's referendum to give himself greater powers has passed by a very narrow margin. The opposition parties are complaining about irregularities. The Electoral Commission there ruled that ballots could be counted even if the envelopes containing them were empty, even if they didn't contain the correct seal. Opposition leaders have been jailed. So it's been a referendum which has perhaps not met the standards you would want in a democratic contest. However, Erdogan is actually very popular, and his plans have also been endorsed by most Turkish diaspora communities where they haven't been having this sort of this fiddling about. So although Turkey has taken quite a large step towards autocracy, it's not an entirely unpopular step towards autocracy.
What do you think, Tim Lawton?
I think this is quite a big step, and all our eyes are on North Korea and Syria at the moment. But Turkey is a very important player. And these are huge powers that Sultan Erdogan is now bringing on himself. He can get rid of will get rid of the prime minister, gives him emergency powers, rule by decree, can dismiss parliament, appointing judges and all sorts of other people on top of the purge that he's already had, apparently going to bring back capital punishment. Well, of course, if they do, then that completely waves goodbye to their membership of the EU. This is a really important step. I think it's a retrograde step from a very important country who we need to be inside the tent and looking west rather than going backwards as they appear to be doing here.
Barry Garton?
I think Stephen's wrong. He says that actually Erdogan is very popular within the country. Erdogan is very popular with half of the population of Turkey. He is very unpopular with the other half. And actually that was shown by the referendum result. If, and who is yet to say whether the election was rigged or was not, but there are certainly worrying signs. If in a rigged election you can only win by 51.3% to 48.7%, actually that doesn't show
a great deal.
Well, yes, a divided country indeed.
Oh, we should have a second referendum.
As you said, there may be a challenge from opposition parties. Now, North Korea, of course, is the other dominant issue.
North Korea are defiant as US ramps up pressure, is the Times angle on it. And on the front of the Mirror, Donald Trump saying they have no choice but to act unilaterally to destroy North Korea's ability to give a nuclear test. Of course, the fear is, and if you don't successfully get all of the missile sites, which British intelligence doesn't, according to a story by Tom Newton Dunn in The Sun, then you have a retaliatory strike on South Korea, on Japan, perhaps even with some of their conventional weapons onto US sites, and that triggers a wider conflict and loss of life.
And Theresa May's privately urged Donald Trump not to launch airstrikes on
North
Korea.
Why privately? You don't urge this privately. As Prime Minister of this country, you come out and you say that we should be working multilaterally through the United Nations, not going behind closed doors on a private telephone conversation. You come out and you say it publicly.
Well, she's having a conversation with Trump, and if she can have some influence on Trump, that's the most important thing. When she says that, I'm sure she is less important than actually speaking in the ear of Donald Trump and getting to do something we'd like him to do.
And in our last few seconds, Stephen, one more headline.
UK relations with Russia are at all-time low. So Russia's ambassador to London has warned that Britain is, in their view, stirring up antagonism. Of course, the Russia-Britain relationship has been in a bad place since the killing of that exile in 2006, and it's only got worse since.
That's on the Daily Mail front page. We will leave it there. If you want any more information about those local elections we were talking about, then you can get full details on the BBC website. That is all we have time for tonight. Thanks to my guests, Barry Gardner, Tim Lawton and Stephen Bush. Join us again same time next week. For now, from all of us at the Westminster Hour, a very good night.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.